Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. This podcast is the second of three FINS webinars focused on the impact of, the context to, and the emergence from the COVID-19 pandemic. FINS is the Public Health Information Network for Scotland, and the webinar was organised by the Glasgow Centre for Population Health and Public Health Scotland as part of the ScotFO collaboration. This podcast was recorded live via Zoom on Thursday the 17th of September 2020, and it includes a talk by David Walsh of the Glasgow Centre for Population Health on The Crisis Before the Crisis, Pre-Pandemic Mortality Trends in UK Cities and Countries, and Ruth Dundas of the MRC/CSO Social and Public Health Sciences Unit, University of Glasgow, on Prioritising Population Health, Calibrating COVID-19 Deaths with Mortality Due to Inequality in the UK.
Welcome everybody. So we're going to start with two 20-minute presentations. So I'd like to start off by welcoming David Walsh. He's a Public Health Programme Manager at the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, and he's responsible for leading a number of different research programmes with health inequalities and the determinants as a key focus of his work. So welcome, David, and I'll hand over to you.
Yes, welcome, Zoomers of the world. We were just saying before you joined us that it's always a very weird way to present this. You're presenting into the void, basically. So I can't see anybody's reactions. I have no idea if you're looking excited and interested in what I'm going to say, or if you're sitting in your pyjamas having a bit of a scratch doing a crossword or whatever. So it's all a little bit weird. For my own sanity, I'm going to assume that you're very interested in what I'm going to talk about, which is about pre-pandemic mortality trends across the UK, as you see on the screen. Now, given this is a series of webinars about the pandemic, you might want to ask whether pre-pandemic trends really matter. And I'm going to argue that they matter massively for a whole number of different reasons. The first being that, as it says on the slides, that we were in a crisis before this crisis, and I'll try and show you that. The second is that you need to understand that to understand the scale of pandemic inequalities that have been much publicised in the news. And the third is that you need to understand it in the relation to coming out of the pandemic. And so with talk of building back better, we need to know where we were to start with. And as I'm going to show you, I don't think we were in a very good place. So yeah, quite an uplifting presentation. There's going to be quite a lot of charts and data, but I'm going to run through them quite quickly, so hopefully it won't be too painful if that's not your thing. Okay, so if I click on this should work. Here we go. So in terms of the background to this project, well, for the background, you have to use your memory, or if that's failing, your imagination, and either remember or imagine a time where if you went, say, on the BBC News website, there were actually other stories than just wall-to-wall pandemic stories. And a year or two ago, there was lots of stories like this about the stalling and improvement in life expectancy. Now, I think if you don't work in public health, to many people that didn't really mean a great deal. But if you do work in public health, then it was ringing all sorts of alarm bells, because basically this shouldn't happen. In wealthy societies, the UK, Scotland, this shouldn't be happening. So the aim of this project was really to look at these changing mortality trends, both at country and, because we had the data, at city level. So we were looking at the four nations of the UK, and then 11 cities across the UK that you see on your screen. So the four largest in Scotland, the six largest in England, apart from London, because it's a bit of a basket case compatibility wise, and also Belfast in Northern Ireland. And we were looking not at life expectancy, but at mortality rates for all cause deaths, and a broad set of individual causes that, again, you see on your screen, and you'll also see as we go through some of the presentation. And we were looking at trends over about 35 to 40 years. It varies a little bit in terms of different countries and their data sets, and analysing by sex, a broad set of age groups, and importantly by deprivation over a shorter time period, using the different national deprivation indices of the countries. And for the Scottish cities, we were also doing analysis by city-specific quintiles of deprivation to give a more detailed insight into urban inequalities in those cities. What does all that result in? It results in a ludicrous number of analysis and the risk for you as an audience of a kind of death by data PowerPoint experience. So to overcome that, I'm just going to try and summarise the main points that came out of it in a very quick 10-minute rapid overview. And I've summarised them under four main headings. So the first set of the results from all these analyses that I want to talk about is that these recent changes in mortality, this slowdown in improvement, stalling in improvement, is seen everywhere in the UK. And that's a really important point. This isn't just about Scotland. So if we look at, for example, this is females of all ages in Scotland and long-term improvement in mortality trends over time, we see here the change in the trend in the most recent period. But the most important point is that the trend in England and Wales is exactly the same as it is in Northern Ireland, suggesting therefore common root cause. If I just put that to one side, I'll show you in a second similar trends for cities. Now, cities are obviously smaller population size, fewer numbers of deaths, so we are more likely to get a lot of kind of fluctuation in rates over time, which can make it a bit more difficult to interpret. Nonetheless, if you look at the six English cities, you do still get this sense of a change in the most recent period with a levelling off in these rates. If you look at Belfast, you're certainly seeing that. In Scotland, you see it for Glasgow in blue at the top. The other cities is a bit of fluctuation, so we'll come back to that in a second. In terms of males, it's basically the same story, this change in rates in the most recent period with this levelling off at the country level. At the city level, the suggestion of that across some of the English cities, clearly seeing it in Belfast. And then again, for the Scottish cities, well, maybe in Glasgow, but again, there's a lot of fluctuation there. So because of that fluctuation, it becomes quite important to try and quantify this change over time, rather than just relying on eyeballing line charts. And I've done that very simply just by looking at the percentage change in rates between five-year blocks. So how much have rates changed between, say, 1981 or the period around 81 and 1985 or the period around 85? How much between 86 and 90, 91, 95, etc., to give a more robust view of change over time. And if you do that at the country level, first of all, then what you see is this continual improvement across the different countries through the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s, until this most recent period where things have stopped improving. And that's basically what you saw in the first chart I showed you, because this is for females of all ages. And for males of all ages, it's basically the same picture. There you go. Improvement, 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 and then really not very much improvement. But the point of doing this is obviously to see to aid interpretation of the charts for the cities. So if we look at the Scottish cities and we'll add Belfast in just to group them together, then that's basically what you're seeing for males, the same picture of improvement through time, through these decades, and then no improvement or indeed potentially a worsening of some rates. This is males. The picture for females is broadly similar with this change in rates in the most recent period. And across the different English cities, again, broadly, it's the same pattern of improvement, 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 and then less improvement, albeit for males, Sheffield in blue and Bristol in green seem to be slightly less affected. But for females, they are affected. And again, you see this clear change in rates in the last period. Now, all of this is for all ages. I want to very, very quickly just mention premature deaths, deaths under the age of 65, because it's a very important topic for health research in Scotland. And the trends there are basically very similar to what I've shown you, but rather than a levelling off in the most recent period in Scotland, we actually see a worsening in mortality rates, increasing in mortality rates. And that's linked to the influence of drug-related deaths I'm going to pick up at the end of the presentation. But that issue aside, we also see quite worrying trends that I'll show you for Dundee. So very quickly, at the country level, this is what I've just said. England and Wales, there's levelling off of rates in the most recent period, but in Scotland, actually, an increase quantified in the graph next to it there. This is males, and then for females, broadly the same picture. And in terms of the cities, again, quite a bit of fluctuation, but this is the trend I'm talking about for Dundee, with this sharp increase in mortality rates in the most recent period. And it goes without saying that in a major city of a wealthy country, this basically shouldn't be happening. We shouldn't be seeing this in our society. So that's the first set of results, just emphasising that these changes are happening everywhere. The second thing I want to say is this slowdown or this stalling of improvement, what it's actually doing is masking increasing death rates among the poorest in society. And again, this shouldn't be happening either. And this is also happening across the UK. So we'll go back to this chart showing female mortality rates in Scotland and this change in the trend in the most recent period. This is not driven by people living in the least deprived areas. This is people in the 20% least deprived neighbourhoods. What it is driven is by people living in the 20% most deprived neighbourhoods where mortality rates have been going up. And again, this just shouldn't happen. And it's worth just emphasising this is not the 1% most deprived or the 5% most deprived. It's the 20% most deprived. So we're looking at a fifth of the population. Importantly, if I put that graph just to one side, the picture for England is exactly the same with this increasing death rate among the most deprived. It's also the same in Northern Ireland. And if we look at males, we're seeing the same thing in Scotland, increasing death rates among the poorest. In England, again in Northern Ireland to a degree. And then in the cities, we see in Glasgow a previously declining trend among the city's most deprived areas, now increasing death rates. Also in Edinburgh, increasing death rates. And although a lot of fluctuation in Aberdeen, basically in the last period, the same thing. And again in Dundee, increasing death rates among the poorest. This again is deaths at all ages. Very quickly mentioned premature deaths, where the story is basically the same, but worse in terms of these increasing death rates in the most recent period for Scotland. There's Glasgow, Aberdeen, and this is the trend I showed a minute ago in Dundee with this increase overall for under 65 deaths. And this isn't about those living in the least deprived areas, but it's quite dramatically about those living in the most deprived areas. Now, when you see a graph like this, and there'll be one or two statos in the audience wanting to point this out, it often means it's just about small numbers, you know, small numbers causing this kind of fluctuation in rates. But actually, I would argue that in a city of Dundee's size, and we're only looking at a fifth of the population, 270 deaths in a three-year period isn't a small number, it's a worryingly large number. Okay, so that's the second of the four things I want to talk about. The third is that these widening inequalities driven by increasing death rates among the poorest in the most recent period are not seen just for one or two causes of death, but actually seen for the majority of the different causes of death that we looked at. I'm short of time today, obviously, so I can't go into this in detail. So if you take one example, which is again, females of all ages in Scotland, these are the 10 different causes of death we've looked at. And the point to really note is that you're seeing widening inequalities driven by increasing death rates in the poorest areas in the most recent time period in the majority of the causes that we look at. The main exceptions are suicide for females, where the gap has narrowed a bit, and motor vehicle transport accidents, where numbers are just very small and there's an awful lot of fluctuation anywhere. But anyway, but otherwise, it's a widening of inequalities. And that widening of inequalities we also see for males, with the exception of cancer, particularly lung cancer, where the gap has actually been narrowing rather than widening. And that relates to different historic trends in lung cancer between males and females that some of you will be aware of. Just to say again that rather than just rely on eyeballing these graphs, we did quantify the change in inequalities by calculating summary statistics of both absolute and relative inequalities. Given the number of graphs I'm throwing at you for everyone's sanity, I'm not going to go into detail with that, but I'll give you two quick examples just to hammer home the point. So this orange line shows for males of all ages in Scotland, relative inequalities. So that's the relative gap across deprivation quintiles and mortality. And relative inequalities were already increasing, but because of these recent changes in the most recent period, they've jumped up further again. Absolute inequalities, that's the absolute gap across the deprivation quintiles, have been going down for a long time. But again, because of these changes, they've also jumped up. So we're now seeing widening relative and absolute inequalities because of these changes. The other quick example is deaths from stroke, cerebrovascular disease, and big jumps in both relative and absolute inequalities because, again, of these changes in the most recent period. Okay, continuing at this ridiculous breakneck speed, and apologies for that, but there's quite a bit to get through. The fourth of the four sets of results I want to show come under the slightly uninspiring headline of that there are various city level issues to highlight. So basically, when doing the analysis, various things kept cropping up for individual cities, and I've tried to summarise these quickly. When writing this up, they were summarised under four headings. But the first two of these I've already shown you, which is that this change in mortality rates happens at city level as well. And I've shown you that already, as I have shown you that that's masking the increasing death rates among the poorest, also occurring at city level. So the third of the four things is that Glasgow, again, and this won't be a surprise to many of you, stands out among the UK cities in terms of having the highest death rates for most causes that we look at. So if you look at all-cause deaths, for example, the individual grey lines are the other UK cities. The big dotted line is England and Wales at the bottom. The small dotted line is Scotland. And Glasgow's always had much higher all-cause mortality rates. And we know the reasons for this, and we've published quite a lot on this in recent years, but it's still quite a striking difference. And even more striking when you look at different causes of death, for example, alcohol-related causes. So again, the grey lines are the other cities, England and Wales at the bottom, Scotland, the small dotted line. And the point of showing this is that the scale of alcohol-related deaths is just completely different in Glasgow, as you see with the blue line. And although they've come down recently, in the most recent period, they've started to go up again. So this is another cause for concern. And the fourth and final point to make is that although Glasgow stands out in terms of having the highest rates, some exceptions do apply, and these also relate to the changes in mortality in this most recent time period that we're talking about. So one example is around death from ischemic heart disease. So this again, England and Wales, Scotland, the other cities, and Scotland always had much higher rates of ischemic heart disease compared to other UK cities. But because of the changes recently, you see that Manchester has now overtaken Glasgow and has the highest rates. And the other exception of note relates to Dundee and drug-related deaths. And I want to more or less finish the presentation just talking about this in a bit more detail because it's very important. So we're using a definition of drug-related poisonings. This is defined by diagnostic codes on death certificates. And it's a broader, less accurate definition than the official national published figures for drug-related deaths. But the figures are very, very similar. And they allow us to do a bit of in-depth analysis across different parts of the UK. And if you do that, what you see is increasing death rates just about everywhere. But the picture is quite dramatically different in Scotland, as many of you will be aware of. It's clearly highly socially patterned, and I'll show you that. And although I'll just show you two or three charts, bear in mind that it's basically the same kinds of trends for all ages, for working ages, and for males and females. So this first chart shows the divergence for males of all ages, the divergence of Scotland from the rest of the UK over time for drug-related deaths, drug-related poisonings, including, as you see, a big jump in the most recent period that we've been talking about. Drug-related deaths, tragically, are obviously more about deaths at younger ages. And so if you look at 15 to 44 year olds, you see this quite dramatic trend, including this further jump in the most recent period. And the picture for 45 to 64 year olds is pretty similar in terms of these overall trends. At city level, we've done a lot of work over the years looking at Glasgow, Liverpool and Manchester and showing how similar cities they are in a number of important regards, but not in relation to drug-related deaths, where the picture in Glasgow is completely different and again influenced by this big change in the most recent period. Deaths from this cause have also been going up in Belfast, as you see there, but Dundee now has the highest rates because again of this big jump in the most recent period. The social patterning of drug-related deaths is very apparent. It doesn't take away the kind of shock value of this particular chart though in terms of the striking trend among those in Scotland living in the most deprived quintile, including again this big increase most recently. And that overall picture for males is basically exactly the same for females, but just on a different scale. Let's do that. So smaller numbers, but the same overall pattern, including this increase in the most recent period. And indeed, this increase in the most recent period among the poorest is seen within the cities. So that's the 20% most deprived of Glasgow, this big, big jump. That's Edinburgh, bottom left, this is Aberdeen. And really, really dramatically, this is Dundee. Now again, a bit of a rustle of anoraks from the statos in the audience saying, well, clearly this must be small numbers. And I suppose you can say that 50 odd deaths in a 3-year period in a statistical sense is a small number, but it's not in a human sense. And you can say the same, I think, for Aberdeen. But actually, when you get to Edinburgh and Glasgow, these are neither small numbers in a human sense or a statistical sense. I think they're actually very, very big numbers, and they're very, very alarming numbers. And with that, and with that ludicrous sprint through all that data, I'm going to kind of stop and try and summarise what I've said at breakneck speed, which is that there are a number of UK-wide issues affecting all of the UK, and this is principally about the slowdown in the rate of improvement in mortality, which is masking increased rates of deaths among the most disadvantaged in society, something that I've said shouldn't happen. There are also Scotland-specific issues, principally the impact of drugs harm, which is driving a worsening of overall mortality rates among the under-65s. What's causing all this? Well, we kind of know, to be honest. In terms of the drugs deaths, it's a perfect storm of an ageing vulnerable cohort who are now encountering multiple morbidities as they age. Increased affordability, accessibility, and the types of drugs on the market, cuts to social security and relevant services in the most recent period, and lots more. And I would point you to the Scottish Affairs Committee report from last year, which highlighted all the evidence for this and also the best recommendations for what to do about it, although those recommendations seem to have been ignored by the UK government. And in terms of the overall mortality trends, the important point is that you have to look at these in the context of all the other evidence out there, both international evidence and lots of research evidence in the UK, of the impact of austerity measures on population health, and conclude that this is further evidence of the likely impact of the UK government's austerity measures, which have been in place since 2010. And just to hammer home that point, these changing rates that I've shown you have coincided with unprecedented cuts to public spending, including truly staggering cuts to social security budgets, which clearly impacts on the most vulnerable in society. And in the words of the United Nations and Philip Alston on his visit to the UK a couple of years ago, in high-income, wealthy countries like the UK, poverty is a political choice. It's not inevitable, it's a political choice. And I think what we're seeing now are the consequences of those political choices. And I think we should have been shouting about this before the pandemic, and we now need to shout an awful lot louder about it to allow those voices to be heard over everything else that's going on. And at that point, I'm going to stop, mention that this will hopefully be published soon, and we'll publicise it when that happens, and let you get back to your crossword or whatever you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks very much, David. Really important work and really important messages for the audience here and everyone, obviously. Please do post questions for David in the Q&A box, and we'll pick those up at the end. First of all, we're going to hear from Ruth, and then we'll pick up all questions after that. So I'd just like to introduce you to Ruth. So Ruth Dundas is a Senior Research Fellow at the University of Glasgow, and she's co-leading the Understanding Inequalities work stream at the MRC CSO Social and Public Health Sciences Unit. And much of her research focuses on inequalities in mortality and the contextual and social influences on health over the life course. So welcome, Ruth. We look forward to hearing what you've got to tell us.
Yeah, so thanks to Diane for the introduction. FINS meetings, as David said, they're always a good opportunity to meet up, and it's a shame that we aren't able to network as usual. And I'd also like to thank the organisers for inviting me to present today. So today I'm going to discuss the contrast between the UK government's response to COVID-19 with their response to health inequalities. As Diane said, I've got a long-standing interest in health inequalities. And really, when the pandemic was starting, I was struck by the sort of immediate response and the policy interventions that were introduced to mitigate COVID-19 compared to how the governments have responded to health inequalities over the years. I'll just take you through some of the examples of the contrast and then pose the question, ask if the difference in response is actually justified. So I want to take you back to February and March of this year. The UK and devolved governments announced many measures to protect the population from the COVID-19 pandemic, and their concern at the time was that the virus will spread, it will overwhelm the NHS capacity to respond, it will reduce economic output as workers become ill, and it will kill large numbers of people. Now let's consider health inequalities. We've just had 20 minutes of David telling us about inequalities are increasing, and they have been increasing over many, many years. The NHS is overstretched and is dealing with illness, much of which is due to health inequalities. The economic output isn't optimal as working age people are sick and unable to work. And a recent Lancet paper from last year showed that inequalities resulted in large number of deaths. So what can governments do to address these concerns? Well, they can follow the science and take urgent and radical action. For COVID-19, that meant a multi-agency approach and interventions at the population level. What can we do about health inequalities? How can these be tackled? Well, it seems if you follow the science, a similar approach is needed. And this multi-agency approach to tackling health inequalities has been acknowledged by many, and this was Dame Sally Davies, the Chief Medical Officer from 2011 to 2019. And she seems to indicate that the government works in departmental silos and a multi-agency approach can't be done. Here's a quote from an interview with her in the HSG in February 2020 when the Marmot Review was published. She says, "There is something terribly frustrating about the Marmot approach. Poverty is at the root of it all, or poor education, he claims. Yes, so what are we going to do about that? I'm from the Department of Health. There's not much we can do about it." And now I'm going to take you through some of the specific contrasts between the response to COVID-19 and health inequalities, and then show some data about why we should be concerned about the limited response to reducing inequalities and mortality. So how timely have the responses been? Well, for COVID-19, it was immediate. On the same day that COVID-19 cases were reported in China, the UK government issued advice on travelling to Wuhan in China. And then 62 days from these cases being reported to full mitigation. So it only took 62 days before they closed the schools, non-essential business sectors were closed, and we were all told to work at home. For inequalities, the Black Report was published in 1980, and it took until 1999 before they had targeted resource allocation in NHS in England. And when that was introduced, that led to a reduction in amenable mortality over the next decade. And for non-health, they had changes to benefits and welfare policies between 97 and 2010, and that did lead to a reduction in child poverty. So you can see the contrast there, immediate for COVID-19, nearly two decades to do something about inequalities. What about the volume of evidence required before the multi-agency action? Maybe there was just vast amounts of evidence for COVID-19 and not so much for around health inequalities. Well, as I said, it took 62 days of reports from the WHO detailing cases and deaths from around the world, as well as deaths and cases in the UK. For health inequalities, there's been a body of evidence from the initial Black Report in 1980, and here's just a short list of other key reports that have been published over the years, and there also is a huge literature on health inequalities saying that we need to do something about it. I mean, I'd argue that although some policies have been introduced and shown to have limited effectiveness, the health inequalities still exist and there isn't much government response. In terms of statements, the WHO, the UK and devolved governments have daily briefings, and from the daily briefings are from a range of high-ranking government ministers. They also have the chief medical officers. In contrast, for health inequalities, the Black Report was published on August Bank Holiday on Monday, and only a few copies were printed. And when Michael Marmot's most recent report on soaring life expectancy was published, it was the Prime Minister's spokesperson who reported promises to level up. And, okay, to be fair, the Health Secretary also repeated similar sentiments, so he did come out and say something, but again, it wasn't televised live or on the radio, it was in the newspapers. And neither of these statements appear on the respective gov.uk communications pages. What about the quality of evidence? Well, for COVID-19, the case fatality rate in March when the UK government had its immediate response was unknown, and it could be argued that it's still unknown. There are estimates of around 1.3% for the UK, but this is likely to be an overestimate as the denominator is unknown because not everyone is tested. However, for health inequalities, all-cause mortality by deprivation uses well-described and validated measures. The measures, the deprivation measures, are badged as national statistics products. The numerator of the total deaths and the denominator population are also high-quality measures coming from ONS and NRS. And there's also a contrast in the language that's used. For COVID-19, they convene the COBRA committee and they have meetings of SAGE. And the CMOs, as I've said, they give verbal briefings on TV and radio and respond to questions. Whereas for health inequalities, although there have been health inequalities task forces, there's no COBRA meetings, and the CMOs provide annual reports, which might be of interest to us in the public health community, but they're not usually accessed by the general public, and there certainly have been no daily health inequality and health briefings. And you might well be asking, why does any of this matter? You know, COVID-19 is, you know, potentially going to cause a large number of deaths. Well, at the start of pandemic, we didn't know what the impact on mortality could be. The team at Imperial College produced a report with the first modelling predictions of the likely scale of deaths under different scenarios. And these models predicted between 20,000 deaths for fully mitigated, bringing all the mitigation measures in, to 500 deaths if it was unmitigated and COVID-19 was to just run through the population. And these do sound like huge numbers, but how do they compare with other causes of deaths? And something else that began at the start of the pandemic, and it's currently still practiced for the Scottish Government, is to report the daily number and the cumulative number of COVID-19 deaths. And there are a number of problems with reporting deaths in this way. Cumulative deaths can only increase. And also it also doesn't take into account the size of the population, like a crude rate would do. More populations or a larger population, more deaths. And also this daily counting doesn't take into account the age structure of the population, like an age standardised rate would. Elderly population leads to a higher number of deaths. And it doesn't take into account the impacts on different age groups, like life expectancy would. So again, how do we, that's as decision makers, practitioners and the public, make sense of these numbers? And 20,000 sounds like a lot, 500,000 sounds like an even, you know, is an even bigger number. So what this next piece of work does is to calibrate the scale of these modelled mortality impacts of COVID-19 using sort of proper epidemiologic methods. And we calibrate these against socially determined causes of death. And we chose deaths due to drug poisoning, suicide and inequality really to put the COVID-19 deaths into the context we already know about. So to reduce these deaths require a similar multi-agency response as with COVID. And by multi-agency, I mean, obviously they require the upstream large-scale population level policies. We need welfare, we need education, we need employment policies to tackle these social determinants. And for COVID-19, I've already said that was physical distancing, work at home. And for those that can't work at home, those that can't work at home, the government brought in various schemes to make sure that people were compensated. We used the predicted COVID-19 deaths from the Imperial College model that we produced in March 2020, because these are the ones that were used by SAGE and the UK government to make their policy decisions. And as I said, we also looked at deaths due to suicide, drug poisoning and inequality. And the way that we considered inequality is about fairness. So a fair way to consider inequality is to imagine that everyone should have the opportunity or the death rate of the least deprived tenth of the population. So we then defined inequality-related deaths as those deaths in excess of the rate of mortality in the least deprived tenth of the population. So you can see this graph here has quintiles, not deciles, but it was just easier to illustrate. So the least deprived has a death rate here, so any deaths above this line is counted as deaths due to inequality. And we calculated the impact on life expectancy for each of these causes for the UK as a whole and also for Scotland. Now, after just saying that crude numbers are problematic, I'm actually going to show them here just so that, because these are how they're reported currently, and also I did show the 20,000 and the 500,000 predicted deaths from COVID to try and put them into a bit of context. So again, these are the projected deaths that the government were using to justify the strategies. And you can see that the unmitigated COVID-19 deaths is by far the largest out of all the causes, resulting in just over 500,000 deaths for the UK and 42,500 for Scotland. But deaths due to inequality are much higher than the fully mitigated COVID-19 deaths. So the fully mitigated COVID deaths for the UK is just over 20,000, but inequality-related deaths is nearly 150,000. And here's the impact on life expectancy in years for each of the causes. An unmitigated COVID-19 pandemic will reduce life expectancy by nearly 6 years in the UK and just over 5 years in Scotland. For the other causes, it's between a quarter and a third of a year, so between 3 and 4 months, which is still quite a significant impact on life expectancy. And deaths due to inequalities impact on life expectancy causes a reduction of 3.5 years in the UK and 4.7 years in Scotland. So the modelled unmitigated COVID deaths would have had a big impact on life expectancy had the pandemic just gone through the population without any mitigation measures. But we hope that this is a one-off or certainly a rare event, whereas on the other hand, deaths due to inequalities happen every year, and these deaths quite quickly overtake the impacts of the unmitigated COVID-19 deaths. So just to put these 3.5 years for inequalities into perspective, because these deaths occur every year, over a 10-year period, if there are around 6 unmitigated pandemics on the scale of the current COVID pandemic, the impact on life expectancy would be less than that of inequalities. So I'm just going to say that again. Over a decade, the impact on life expectancy from inequality-related mortality is equivalent to 6 unmitigated COVID-19 epidemics. And the reason that the contrasting the response of governments to these different health problems, you know, is concerning is it's because this differential reaction shapes the media coverage, which in turn shapes the public's understanding and potential for future effective action. I mean, I would argue that the policy response does need to match the scale of the problem. COVID-19 has shown that population health matters to people, that's to governments and also to the public. And the government can respond to the challenge with a multi-agency approach. Inequalities in health and mortality are a result of the social determinants of health and the unequal distribution of them across the population. So they also require these upstream, large-scale population level policies. We need welfare, we need education, we need employment policies to tackle these social determinants. And despite political and public support for these types of policies, it seems they choose not to implement them to reduce health inequalities. So really, what can we in public health, whether we work in research, policy or practice, do? Is there anything that we can learn from COVID-19? Well, we can keep the mantra, follow the science. Public health needs to keep on pushing the agenda and not allow health inequalities to be ignored. It is hard to tackle, but a wise man once told me, just because something is difficult doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Something else that kind of occurred to me is, do we need a new exciting name for health inequalities? We had COVID-19, how about Inequal 2020? And really, if the political and policy action was to be taken in proportion to the impact on mortality, then comprehensive action on health inequalities should at least be prioritised to the same extent as the COVID-19 pandemic. And finally, I'd just like to acknowledge the data providers and collaborators with this work. Thank you. And just some additional resources from SPHSU if anyone's interested in reading these.
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you'd like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.